I'd like to thank everybody who helped open our meeting today by doing the readings. As I stated, this is a speaker meeting, and the person that's in the chair tonight, I met at this meeting. Many years ago. And I popped in here when this meeting was on Skype. And can everybody check their mics, Ellie? There we go. And there were a couple of people in the room, I think maybe three or four, maybe five. And I was looking for, I found this meeting looking for what from the website that was there at the time. And it had one meeting a week at that point. And talked to Steve, and we sat down. I mean, we talked to everybody. It was only four or five of us in the meeting, and we hung out for a little bit and started talking about online meetings and all kinds of things. And I was like, this is pretty cool. And I have watched him grow. I have watched the Highlands and Islands grow. People have come, people have gone. One of the bedrocks of this set of groups has been Steve. And the neat thing for me with Steve is that we've gotten to break bread together and gotten to share lots of time in recovery, both physically and virtually. And it's been amazing the journey that I've gotten to have with him so far. He's one of the few people that I go to meetings with today that has met members of my family. Before my father moved to Costa Rica. And that's neat for me. Not everybody gets to meet, or not a lot of people have met my parents because they're not involved in the program with me. They're very happy that I'm here, but not involved. So without further ado, I look forward to hearing his experience, strength, and hope for 40 to 45 minutes or however long he wants to speak about his journey. And he just celebrated a milestone. And I'll let him tell you about that. Steve, would you share with us?
Thank you, Jay. I'm an addict. My name's Steve.
Yes.
Hi, Steve.
And yeah, thank you for that introduction, Jay. It's been a privilege. I remember at the end of that conversation, I literally threw you the keys and said, go on with it, start meeting, and you did, and it was cool. And we haven't looked back since. Like Jay said, and most people in the room know, I celebrated a milestone recovery this week at 29 years. And been kind of numb with it a bit, to be honest. I've shared about it. I got asked to share in a meeting yesterday and shared about that a little bit. And I'm just always utterly and completely blown away about that. The fact that I'm here still after all these days, and somehow or another, that's become more than half my life I've spent in Narcotics Anonymous, I think now, just about. And, you know, it's amazing to me that I got a day clean, let alone the days that I've got. And I'm incredibly grateful to be here. I'm incredibly grateful to have had the opportunity to have been part of this group for the last 10 years.
and be here tonight sharing with you, being given that honour of being able to share my experience, strength and hope in a meeting with people that I love to bits. And I love all of you, you know, you're all part of my life, one way or another. So yeah, I guess, you know, I've been thinking about a couple of things recently, the last couple of days. I don't know what I'm going to do. There's a couple of things I thought about recently. There was a great line in the Living Clean in the reading that we did in the meeting last night that said we're called upon many times to share our story, or more or less. I remember being about 18 years clean, and I'd been invited to share in a meeting. And I was kind of embarrassed by it because there was no one else in that meeting that had anything like the clean time I had. It got to that point, and I was kind of just coming back to the fellowship after having taken a bit of a hiatus away from it. And it all felt a bit new again. I think it was a couple of years back in to engaging with the process. And I had one of those little moments of clarity that we get in recovery. I get in recovery every now and again, a penny drops. It's like, okay, you know, that makes it different. And that particular occasion, I realized that, you know, I was sharing this with another member this afternoon, actually. My recovery doesn't belong to me as such. You know, it belongs to you. You know, you guys, it belongs to Narcotics Anonymous, whatever that is, whatever that means, however we understand Narcotics Anonymous to be. And for me, it's the members. It's about the people that were there before me that made it possible for me to be here all these years later, doing what they were doing, which was sharing their experiences and hope, and that's all they were doing. And on that basis, it's not unreasonable now and again for any of us, I think, me included, to kind of give a bit of a progress report. I mean, am I looking after this gift, you know? Am I honouring it? Am I cherishing it? Am I looking after it? You know, am I keeping it in good condition? Am I allowing it to grow and nurture inside me, to be able to pass it on in good shape to the next addict I find that might need it? And that's not always a guarantee. You know, we can share our experience, strength and hope in a meeting, and sometimes people might not get it. Some, you know, if one addict in a room gets something out of anything that we share, I've come to understand, for me, that, you know, kind of that's okay, you know. That's kind of good enough. You know, and, you know, I've been thinking about my journey. What brought me here? You know, why am I here? That's my favourite reading in all the readings that we do in our meeting. I love that reading. Why am I here? And it's a question I need to ask myself on a regular basis, because it's very easy for me to sometimes misunderstand that. Mainly, I guess partly because, you know, it's where I am is in the grand picture of it all. You know, it's ego, it's all those things. You know, and what brought me here is really important to me. I've needed in my journey in recovery to get some understanding of why am I here, what brought me here, and there's a myriad of things, you know. I'm not going to belabor it. I mean, people that know me know where I came from and know who I am, you know. But there was one incident kind of bring me on to what I want to, the other thing I've been thinking about. I remember it really distinctly. When I was born in Liverpool. I was brought up the first early days of my life in a place called Birkenhead, which is across the river, just across the Mersey. And we had this riverfront flat that we lived in. I think it was on the first, it was either the first or the second floor. I think it might have been the first floor. Big flat. I remember it as being big because I was about 3 years old, you know, and everybody looks big at being 3 years old. But I can smell it, I can taste it, you know. It was very 1950s. There was open fires and, you know, the kettle was always on, and there was an old gas cooker and all those things, you know, brown furniture and overstuffed armchairs and all that kind of thing floating about. There wasn't a lot there, but I do remember it. Both my parents were working people. My mother, I'm not sure what my mother did back then, completely. I had a sister that was a couple of years older. My father was kind of was absent a lot of the time. And we used to get looked after by this woman that lived in the flat downstairs, and she was called Mrs. McCrae. She was actually Norwegian, strangely enough. I have a Norwegian connection in my life today. Who knew? But it's on this one particular occasion, she's in the house looking after me and my sister, who's what, five, I'm three. And I found myself touching an iron and remember being really, like, I've hurt myself. I've touched this iron and I'm running around screaming and I want my mum. And she's not there, but this Mrs. McCrae was, and she picked me up and did her best to kind of console me, but it wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't my mum. You know, I remember being filled with this deep sense of loss, of disappointment, of, you know, abandonment. All those things went on through my mind. I can remember it really clearly, and there's a few other things I can remember from very clearly, but that's one of them. And I know it's not a memory that's been planted there because people spoke about it, because why would anybody else even remember it, you know, because it was just a one-off. I never spoke to my mother about it. You know, and I think I carried that feeling with me then for, you know, right through my, almost up to today, probably. You know, that it wasn't enough. And it was about my expectations, you know. At that age, you know, I expected to be the people in my life that were supposed to be there for me, to be there for me, and they weren't that, in that instance, you know, and it sort of set something up inside of me, you know, that I've heard it said that, you know, things that happen in the first 3 years of our lives kind of set the tone for the rest of our lives and kind of almost mould us, if you like, into what we're going to become as grown-ups. And if I look at my life as a kid and everything that went on, that was always what it was. It was, nothing was ever enough. You know, I was never enough. You know, I never felt that people met the expectations I had of them, you know, one way or another. So I was in a constant state of disappointment. That's really was what my life was, you know. I never got the right Christmas presents, I never got the right birthday presents. Certain things happened, you know, that just seemed to all add up to, you know, leading me to a place where I felt, well, if that's the case, maybe I'm not worth it. You know, maybe other people don't think that I'm worthy of giving them either things that I need or think that I need, one way or another. And that's everything from, you know, the way they felt about me, the way they talked to me, the way they behaved around me, all of that kind of stuff. And all the kind of physical stuff as well, you know. And we were poor as kids. I learned later on, many years later, that was because my father was running two families at the time, because my mother was the other woman. In a what transpired to have been an incredibly messy divorce, which in the 1950s in the UK was, you know, something that was never talked about. You know, I brought that with me, you know, and I, in a way, it doesn't surprise me at all that I became a using addict, you know, because everything I did and all my thinking and everything else was around combating that feeling of not being worthy and not feeling that anything was ever good enough, or that nothing ever was enough, you know. I mean, no one could meet my expectations because my expectations were completely unrealistic. My thinking was off. I shared yesterday about having this sense of weirdness about me, that I didn't fit in, I wasn't part of the world, you know. The world was out there, but it didn't have a place, there wasn't a place for me in it somehow. And so much of that comes back to those feelings when I was this little three-year-old boy, feeling as if I'd been left behind, you know. You know, and that carried on for the rest of my life, all the way through, right until, you know, 37 years old, Narcotics Anonymous found me, desperate, broken and lonely human being, you know. Back where I'd been when I was 13 years old, you know, desperate and suicidal, you know, wanting it to end. You know, I couldn't live with it anymore, you know. It all, the pressure of it, I think, got so much I just couldn't cope, you know, that those ex the expectations were continuing not to be met, you know, and I didn't still didn't feel that people really cared for me. I was a kind of inconvenience. That's how I felt in the world, you know, I'd been lied to and people had done things, and you know, I can't say I had a bad childhood because I didn't. And I don't blame what the choices I made as a grown up that led me to Narcotics Anonymous on any of them or any of that. You know, it's me, you know, I am the problem today. You know, Steve, not anybody else. Certainly as a grown up, but what I'm able to do today is acknowledge those feelings, and I've become to understand them a little bit and be able to put them in some sort of perspective that they make sense, because none of it made any fucking sense to me. Absolutely nothing until I started working this program, you know, and I got here and you guys were there telling me that it would be okay, you know, and I share this a lot, you know, that you know, that sense for the first time in my life, you know, that maybe there was something else in this weird world of mine. You know, and there were other people in this weird world of mine that understood me and that would be able to kind of guide me through that forest of confusion, which is really where, when I, by the time I stopped, got to the end of my using, I was just confused, very lonely. You know, and I started working these steps, you know, and that you suggested I might try, you know. I mean, initially, because I'm one of these treatment kiddies, you know, I went through treatment because I'd never, NA wasn't on the agenda back then. And for me, not where I was, and no one ever mentioned it. But I found myself in this 12-step treatment place, you know, and they started getting me to look at the steps and work the steps. And begin to understand what they were trying to say to me. And I could sit here and lie and say, well, yeah, of course, all the steps made absolute fucking sense, but none of them really did at the very beginning. Like, I understood them on some levels. I understood what there was being asked of me on an intellect, being asked to examine my life. I was being asked to be honest about what was really going on. I was being asked to look at my behaviours, you know, step one. You know, powerless over my addiction, and fucking my life was unmanageable. I mean, the unmanageable side of it was fucking obvious. I mean, it was, you know, it was really, really obvious. You know, I struggled a bit with powerlessness because I didn't believe I had a problem with drugs. I thought it was something else, or, you know, not in the totality in which Narcotics Anonymous suggests that we do look at it, which is saying, well, don't use any drugs because they're bad for you, you know, they will fuck you up. And I never saw it like that. And I did have one experience. I went to a meeting of the other fellowship, which is the first meeting I ever went to, and got confronted by someone who made me go away and then think about, well, okay, well, alcohol is a drug because I used alcohol long before I accept substances, other substances. And other things, you know, food, thinking. My thinking was addictive, very weird, obsessive compulsive. All of those things, you know, which are all part and parcel of what makes my addiction, you know. And it talks about that in the basic text. From the beginning, it defines what addiction is, you know, that obsession to use, that compulsion to do things, even if we know that and recognise that they're destructive, and we do them anyway. And that was me, you know, and I slowly began to understand what step one was asking of me. And it was getting me to say, well, you know, all the broken promises, all the times I tried to control it, all the times I swapped from one to another and thought that that was a good idea, and all of those things, you know, and I, you know, over time it started making some sense. You know, and then you were asking me to consider the fact that actually, well, I have a disease and actually I'm not responsible for any of this. I like that idea. I thought that was really cool.
Okay, I'm not responsible. I'm crazy.
But the part of me that being awakened by the realizations in step one said, well, listen, you need to grow up the fuck, you need to grow the fuck up here and take some responsibility and get honest and admit the fact that, because I could never solve any of my own problems. I was incapable of solving my own problems. Absolutely and utterly. I had no clue. At that point, I'd run out of ideas. I couldn't believe my own fucking press anymore, and I couldn't justify or explain away my behaviour anymore, because it had just got to the point where it was just not working. The more I took, that song, The Verve, isn't it? The drugs don't work, and that was me. I couldn't escape all this crazy thinking anymore. It was just there with me all the time. I was psychotic and crazy, and I was in psychosis a lot of the time, which I guess is the Narcotics Anonymous version of a blackout, where I'd find myself in places and I've no memory of getting there and fucking no clue why I was there even, and had nothing of the thing, none of the things that I had with me before I went into that space and came out of it. It's like, well, I've got no money, I've lost things, what the fuck is going on? And really, I suppose, in a funny kind of way, I mean, that was it, really, because by the time I got here, I'd lost everything, literally. I had nothing. Beat up old Renault 5 that my life was squeezed into, because there was so much of it I didn't want to let go of. And then he suggested to me that I might think about, looking for a solution outside of myself. Become willing to at least consider the idea that there was a power greater than me that might be able to help me. And that set up a whole chain of events that made me start realizing, I think, slowly that Narcotics Anonymous might be it. I didn't like God. God was like everything else in my life. It was never enough. Didn't meet my expectations. Therefore was the enemy. So working through that process was quite difficult for me. But again, like little things would drop into place and it started getting better. And, my step three, I had an experience. I've shared this a lot in that place that I was in, where the universe came down and wrapped me up and said, listen, it's going to be okay. I've got you. You can survive this. You're going to survive this. You're going to find a way through all of that turmoil. It didn't promise me when. I remember being full of that sense of, I just needed to be patient with myself. One of the people around me just start to begin to work the process, I remember being asked to write about step three. And I think I filled 2 pages of foolscap, because I'm a wordy bastard, you might have noticed. My writing is no better. And I took it to this man and he said, no, that's not it. And I went back with one sheet of foolscap and he said, no, that's not it. I went back with half a sheet of foolscap and he said, no, that's not it. And eventually the penny dropped and I went back and I'd written I hand my will of my life over to a power greater myself. He says, congratulations, you've just worked step three. And that was it, today's just for today. I surrender my will of my life to a power greater than me. I've continued to do that. And then stuff got really difficult because you were suggesting that what I ought to do is kind of write about all that confusion, write about those feelings, all that hate and anger and confusion, and put it on paper in an attempt to free myself from it. And that worked in parts. My first experience of working step four was deeply unsatisfactory, if I'm honest. I did my best, but I wasn't really, I don't think I was ready for it at that point. A month into recovery, I don't think I was capable. So I did my best and wrote this stuff up. And then I got put in front of this guy that was supposed to be listening to a step five, and I don't think I had enough time to really consider step five. It was a bit of a rush job, you know, because it was only 6 weeks in that place of kind of. But it started the process for me, and I think just the experience of admitting to, you know, myself, my God, and another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. You know, to talk about those things for the first time ever to another human being, to a stranger, and not be vilified. You know, not be left with that feeling of nothing was ever enough, or that my expectations haven't been met. You know, and it kind of worked for me. It set me on the road, you know. It got me to a point where I began to sense a bit of freedom from all of that craziness, you know. And I'd started to, I'd been encouraged to look at some of my positive stuff. I remember writing, my biggest fear on the top of the list was losing my hands, because I work with my hands. I always have and probably always will. And it was my biggest fear. And the woman said to me, she says, what are the chances of that? I said, well, I don't fucking know. It's not relevant. Said, yeah, well, it is, she said. Yeah. And I was able to kind of let that go a little bit as well. You know, but all those little things, you know, but I realised, I have talents, and I am good enough, you know, to be in this world. And that was really where I was at. I was at a point, like, you know, I said, you know, I didn't believe I belonged here. You know, it was almost like I was kind of born out of phase from the rest of the world. But I started feeling a part of again, you know, and that's kind of what I got from that step. And you know, step six, you know, entirely ready to have my defects of character removed, and you know, having done all that other work I'd already done, this was my first sponsor now. They'd let me out by then. Put me back in the general population kind of thing, you know, my thinking about that was, well, would they have done that if I was still as mad as a box of frogs? And maybe not, you know, if they didn't think I was ready, they wouldn't have agreed to let me go. I don't know what was going on in my mind, but you know, there I was back in the real world, you know, beginning to rebuild my life after 6 months of being coddled. It was a bit like taking a driving license. I thought I've shared this before too, you know, we don't learn to drive until the first day we get in a car on our own. You know, or you've been deemed to be safe to go out in the real world with a loaded gun and drive it around the streets. It's like, okay, you know, but there I was, you know, and I started working on that process, you know, and had a few scares along the way. You know, but it was working. I could feel all these things working in my life, you know, and I was willing to allow for the possibility that, you know, if I continued doing it, it was going to get better. You know, more will be revealed, it tells us in the basic text. And it's absolutely right. You know, the longer I've been around, the more I see. You know, and step seven again, you know, like, you know, okay, well, I am, you know, again, I handed my will and my life over and my shortcomings and said, okay, you know. It was patently obvious that my thinking led me to the place where I was back at step two and repeating the same mistakes over and over again, expecting different results. And maybe that higher power that I welcomed into my world was able to help me with that. You know, and again, you know, that principle of patience came into my life. Again, that principle comes up in my life, patience. I was always an impatient bastard. I wanted it and wanted it now because I'm an addict. In fact, I wanted it yesterday. But the world isn't like that, is it? You know, which I think is also related to that whole kind of thing. Nothing is ever enough. My expectations were far too big, far too unrealistic. And it was the same with that, you know, that and that thinking that, well, I think, you know, work the steps, everything's going to be fine, you know what I mean? It's great, like, pass the test. But it isn't a test, is it? It's the beginnings of the understanding of the journey, you know, saying this is the introduction to, this is like the brochure for the trip. You know, my first experience of working all these steps is like, this is the brochure for the trip. This is the itinerary. These are some of the things you might expect, and these are some of the places you may or may not go. You know, your choice to get off the bus is contingent at any moment based on the choices you make that you're now able to do because you've worked step one and you have an understanding that an admission of powerlessness is an empowerment. You know, the choice is mine. It's always been mine in recovery, nobody else's. And you know, kind of moving on through it, you know, step eight, you know, okay, so now make a list of all the people you've harmed in your life. And having been aware of all the shit that I went through in 4, 5, 6, and 7, it was like, okay, yeah, I've harmed a few people in my life. Not least of all myself. And my amends began with me. I'm here. I'm doing this. I'm going to meetings. I'm being of service. I'm doing the things that you're asking of me. And that's part of that process because it's about humbling myself. A lot of it. And I think step eight's a lot about that. And I started making a list. That list is not complete. I can't remember all the people I harmed in my life. I have absolutely fucking no idea. So I have no control over that sometimes. My life was a stone in a puddle of water, you know. The ripples went out forever and never stopped. You know, the damage was being done. Even after I got clean, I suspect. You know, I hurt people. And hurt myself, and I was paying. And you know, one of the things that all those early steps showed me was that, you know, I might not have been responsible for my addiction, but there are consequences for that, for what I did, and I need to be responsible for those, including my own recovery. And I made such amends wherever possible. I mean, short of taking an advert out in the fucking Times or something saying Steve says he's sorry, I was never going to be able to make physical amends to everybody I'd harmed in my life. Which brought me to another place of humility. It brought me to another place of realising, well, I'm never going to be able to do that. How do I deal with it? And that process started making sense that, you know, a lot of it was about forgiving myself. If I could forgive myself, A, I could made me capable of forgiving other people, but also meant that, you know, I could accept forgiveness on some level from other people. You know, I've made, I believe, for me, the amends that I really needed to make to those in my life that were close to me and some on the periphery that I've had the good fortune of being able to do that with, and again, humble myself for that process. You know, and step 10 for me is all about, you know, step 10 for me is about, okay, well, how am I fucking up today? What step do I need to apply to put it right? Or, you know, what have I done good? Have I done good today? You know, and what do I need to be grateful for? Either in my life or in other people, or how the steps have worked to improve my living standards, or, you know, and by that I mean spiritually and emotionally. I mean, the physical stuff is neither here nor there, is it really? It doesn't fucking matter whether I got money in my pocket or not. You know, if I'm truly handing my will and my life over to a higher power, I'm going to be okay no matter what, you know. And, you know, all those little bits and moments of understanding and stuff are all kind of mixed up in working all those other steps. You know, and I go back to the earlier steps and it's like, oh, so suddenly things start making sense, you know. What was nothing was ever good enough has become good enough. You know, I can live on nothing. I can live with money in my pockets as well. You know, that's okay. It's all good. You know, it's all part of what that journey is. There's a lesson in all of it for me, if I'm willing and open-minded enough to see it for what it is. you know, that conscious contact. And I think conscious contact in step 11, you know, and that's a funny one for me. I practiced meditation when I was a using addict, and in recovery, I didn't really get into that as much. You know, I'd find places and time and moments where I would stop and think about what was going on, clear my mind of all the fucking craziness that was going on inside it. You know, because you know, having worked all these steps doesn't mean I'm instantaneously free of any of it. You know, I mean, it's still all going on. You know, the fucking movie never ends. You know, oh my God. Some days it feels like that. But, you know, having gone through the process of begun that journey into the steps and applying the steps in my life and being able to understand the principles have allowed me to come closer to my sense of what my heart, whatever that is. I don't put a name to it. I don't try and define it. I just know it's there. You know, complete faith that my higher power is behind me. And whether that be you guys or something else, or my partner or my kids, or the little old lady crossing the street, or the way someone smiles at me in a shop, or whatever it is, it can be anything. You know, my higher power is all around me, in all things. And, you know, I value that part of my recovery. I value step 11 because I've learned what I have learned, the practice I've learned to in my life today is that I take moments out of my life to just stop. Just fucking stop, you know. When I know that my thinking is out of left field and it's out of order, and you know, other results of what I'm thinking and feeling and how I'm I might be about to react, gonna mean that I need to go back to 10 and then consider another step to think about how I need to address. I stopped. Well, I found myself in fucking plumber's merchants before now, quoting a serenity prayer under my breath. You know, and that's part of that process, you know. And it works for me, you know. How I work my program doesn't work, might not work for everybody, you know, but that's okay too, you know, because we all find our own place on the bus, you know, in the journey. We all find a way to understand these things and kind of turn kind of concepts into things that we can see in real life. And that's what I, you know, that's what I found I've been able to do over the years. You know, and step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these steps. Try to carry the message to the still forever addicts and practice these principles of our affairs. I mean, it's almost a given, isn't it, really? I mean, I think to have got to step 12 and begun to work on it and begin to understand it, I realised that my recovery up to that point had been an absolute plethora of spiritual experiences. You know, the dawning of understanding, the dawning of acceptance, the dawning of realization that, you know, I'm not the monster I convinced myself I was. You know, the understanding that I am lovable, you know, the discovery of the fact that I can do good things in the world and help people in all kinds of areas, no matter what it is, in my work life, in my service work in Narcotics Anonymous, and in my family life, you know, I'm so much more capable today of being a positive influence on all those things, you know, or bringing a positive influence to all those things. And a lot of it is unconscious. I don't think about it. I don't think about, well, am I going to be a good person today? You know, or am I going to be a bad person today? It's not like that, you know, for me anyway. So I just try my best. And I honestly believe that's all NA ever asked of me, was to do your best with any of this. Figure it out. You know, learn to believe that you're worth the effort in all areas, you know. And I'm still not good at that either. I'm not good with my physical health. My missus suggested I got up and went for a walk today. I don't do a lot of that. I don't see the point in walking around in things I've had my head in. But I've been sat in for a few days. I haven't done a lot. She said, go for a walk. So I got up and went out for a walk around the block. I came back, she gave me a hug. She said, oh, I'm so proud of you. You know, and little things like that break my heart. You know, because I still struggle with those things. I still struggle with, am I good enough? I still struggle with, you know, am I worth it? Sometimes I neglect myself occasionally. My father-in-law told me that. He said I was generous to a fault. My stepfather, sorry, said to me once, he said, you're generous to a fault. He said, but that's your biggest problem. He said, if you've got half a loaf of bread, you'll give someone a quarter of it. And that's kind of true of me, I think. Even if it means that, you know, I've only got a quarter of a loaf of bread. But I mean, I believe in this power, you know, and that this power in my life says, well, that's okay to only have a quarter of a loaf of bread because there's another half a loaf coming along, you know. Just be patient. It'll happen. Be all right. And it seems to work, you know, it seems to be the case, you know. Yeah, so it's the journey continues. It really does. I'm a work in progress. I ain't perfect. I don't pretend to be. I've not used for a lot of years. I'm aware that I'm not immune. I've watched addicts with a lot more clean time than I've got to go out there and use and die, and that breaks my heart. Every time an addict goes back out there, it breaks my heart, whether they're a day clean or 40 years or 50 years or whatever it is. Like another star goes out. You know, it's tragic and sad. You know, but I've learned so many things. You know, I understand today that this is a program for people that want it. If you want this program and you're new to this program, believe that. You know, understand it for yourself. You know, be the person that keeps coming back. You know, never give up. You know, and that's what you taught me. You taught me never give up. You know, don't cave in at the slightest fucking molehill that comes along, and decide that it's too big a hurdle to get over. Because we can all get through so many things in recovery. Someone shared that the other day. It was a really nice, you know, illness, death, grief, joys, all that stuff. And I think I shared yesterday, I bring it all down current to, you know, how does this stuff work in my life today? You know, this week, there's been highs and lows, you know, from seeing children I haven't seen for a long time. I'm reconnecting with my daughter that I haven't spoken to us for a long, long time. And I'm actually going to do a bit of a video call with her tomorrow and help her do some planning for a little business she wants to start up because she's getting involved in it. She's on the journey. She might not be in the same journey I'm on, but she's on her own journey, and I see it in her, you know, and I'm really proud of her. You know, and to be told that, you know, we're going to expect another grandson, and a couple of days later being told there'd been a miscarriage and that wasn't going to happen, and my pain for them. My heart was fucking bursting. You know, I'm being clean 29 years and then spending a day and a half in bed because I'm ill. You know, but I don't have to use on any of that stuff anymore. You know, I can sit here and I can share about it. I can tell you how I feel. And I know you're going to listen. You know, and I know that what I'll get back is love and empathy and compassion. And that's what these programs taught me to hold in my heart for you and for everybody that I encounter. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be in recovery. I'm incredibly grateful to everyone in this room that's listening to me waffling on about my journey, what it's meant to me. Well, thank you for listening. I'm going to leave it there. Back to you, Jay. Thank you.